when it is over, I fear there will be little left of our world.
You read your books about UFOs and Roswell and whacked out theories and government conspiracies. I think that you want to believe. What makes you trust them?
I don't know. I'm a good judge of character.
This is On Planet Radio.
Another dimension, a dimension of insight, a dimension of understanding. You are entering a place where reality collides with truth. There are no limits, there are no boundaries. This is On Planet Radio.
It's live, Jim, but not as we know it. Not as we know it. Not as we know it. Great fun. Always fun. Sometimes the suspense makes it all worthwhile. And as usual, technical difficulties beset us because it is the internet. It's the man's machine, and we're just riding it. Welcome to Off Planet Radio Live for the final day of July 2013. God, I am so glad to see July gone, and apparently the heat with it. Hope it's cool where you're at, or hope that you are chilling. If not, looks like the chat room's chilling tonight. you guys are awesome. You sat here and rode this out while we did the white knuckle ride trying to get things up. And my guest is with me tonight, Doc Vega. Chris Holly is here as well. And those of you on the live stream may notice you got forwarded over to a slightly different webpage. It is actually part of the new website. We moved the streaming operations there over the weekend because it's a better server with much better response time. So this is leg one of what will eventually be the new website. Next week, Ken Pfeiffer will be joining us from worldufophotosandnews.org. And he's going to bring us up to date with the visual sightings around the planet. August 14th, Richard Pam Nasano of the Searcher Group is going to be here, and we are stocking the shelves right now with guests throughout the month of August. Schedules will go up when I have time. And yes, my guest is here, so no, we don't need to do any of that. Thanks, guys. Chris Holly's here as well. Good evening, Chris. Welcome. Oh, wait a minute. I don't have you up. There you go. There you are.
There I am.
Here you are. Yeah.
Glad to be here. Hello to everybody out there. Hello, Doc Vega.
Good evening, Doc Vega.
Hello.
Good evening. And we had some massive problems getting connected, but we're good now. Everybody's here. Chris, we always...
some type of an extraterrestrial intervention.
That wouldn't be the first time, Doc.
No.
Actually, I had something like that happen on the last paranormal radio show I was on the internet. They had black helicopters hover over their studio.
Chris, what did I tell you? I'm waiting for the helicopters to come over.
Oh, jeez.
So,
let's not wish for that.
Well, it's happened here more than a few times. Yeah, so let's just go ahead and launch into it. Doc, you come to us kind of through UFO Digest, and I didn't get a chance to really give you a proper introduction. You describe yourself as a traveler through space and time. You are a political commentator, author. You are a columnist for UFO Digest as well as some other periodicals. You've done TV and radio talking about UFOs and a lot of other topics as well. So tell us a little bit about how you got into, I guess we'll call it the fringe. Or did you always live in the fringe?
Well, you know, I started out as a kid in junior high, you know, in my study hall class reading these amazing UFO, you know, sightings that were going on. And I remember a kid after, you know, after football practice or whatever, you know, getting in the study hall and reading this stuff. And I was going, it's amazing how the media always laughs this off or acts like it doesn't exist. Yet we've got generals admitting to the, you know, reality of UFOs. So I was perplexed. I was going, why do we have this, you know, yin and yang, you know, relationship with reality here when it comes to the official version as opposed to what really is happening by trained observers and the testimonies that are quite impressive and the type of high-ranking brass in the military that swear that, you know, that this is going on. I mean, what is this, a disinformation campaign, or do we just have a schism, you know, that results from the government and the government speak, so to say, that comes out of the media, you know, which always parrots the lies of the government, but rarely do we actually get the truth. So, you know, I began to raise an eyebrow and I was thinking to myself, you know, there's a lot more to this than most people realize. And, you know, that was kind of my introduction into it.
So I guess the question is, and we can ask this between the three of us because we all kind of are cut from the same fabric. What the hell is it that puts us in line with being curious about this? And I know Chris's story because she's told it a number of times, and I have my own stories, and I have my own sense of why I've kind of always been tapped into this. But is there some reason why we talk about this when most of the general public's more worried about the baseball
the latest game. Reality show?
The latest, yeah, unreality show.
Yeah. You know, or you know, the latest, you know, ball game or the latest, rumors about whatever celebrity's life everybody's supposed to be glued to, you know, all the distractions that take us away from what really means anything in life.
Exactly. And yet you seem to, be plugged into this. You were plugged into it as a kid, so was I. I mean, when I was growing up in the 1970s, I was doing research on this. I did a science fair project in eighth grade that actually won a second place award statewide on UFOs at a time when nobody was talking about UFOs. And, you know, unfortunately then we didn't have much. We had Operation Blue Book, which was a disinfo campaign, but there even then was anecdotal evidence as well. What finally did you conclude was your genetic predisposition towards curiosity of anomalous craft in the sky?
Well, let's put it this way. When you're a little kid, about 6 years old, you're standing on your porch in Los Angeles, California, not too far from Hollywood and Vine, where the stars drive up and down the streets and you can see them all the time, and you see an opaque object that looks like a semi-translucent reddish globe that is tumbling through the sky. And before you can yell to your family and your brothers, you know, what you've just seen, it's passed over your house and it's in the distance. I think that's a pretty good introduction into, another reality.
Yeah.
And I can see it as plainly now in my mind as I saw it as a child. And I was pretty well aware of what was going on at that time because there was a lot of sonic booms and a lot of news, that was going on about experimental aircraft and all the Air Force and rocketry news that was around. So even as a kid, I was really pretty well aware of what goes on in the sky already. so that I would be able to discern an unusual event from something that was, you know, just mundane and routine, or conventional, as you might call it.
Now, you recall a sighting that you had as a child. Was that the only sighting that you ever had, or did you seem to have, let's just say, synchronous experiences later on in life?
Yes, I have, and also even my, I was a single parent that raised four children, and two of my kids also told me that they had sighted things, you know, that were very, very unusual in the sky. Nocturnal sightings.
Mm-hmm. How many people do you think have had sightings and because of their programming are not able to, well, it's what we call cognitive dissonance. In other words, my suspicion for a long time has been that more people have seen anomalous things, but they simply cannot connect their entrained frontal vision to process something, so there's like this blackout that occurs.
Well, you know, the brain does filter things out unconsciously, and I'll give you an example. In between 1993 and 96, I was a columnist for the Plano Star Courier, and I was part of investigating an abductee support group. And one of the people there was kind of like a high public visibility person. So they had to play down their role in the group because, you know, being a corporate head and everything, you know, they didn't want to have their, you know, company say, oh, we're disclaiming this, you know, whatever this individual is involved in, our company has, you know, no knowledge and doesn't support that view. So anyway, this lady was telling me, and she lived in a nice, upper middle class neighborhood, that she came out of her house one day, and here is an object in midday hovering across the street. And there's a neighbor out in their yard, you know, like raking leaves or something, completely oblivious to what's going on. And here she comes out of her house, it's the first thing she notices in the sky. And like you said, I mean, you know, some people are simply programmed to filter that out of their consciousness.
Yeah, one of Chris and I's early conversations had to do with people, and specifically abductees, but even people who have experienced sightings, and the fact that even if you're with people in who are with you in an actual event, one of two things happens. They either process it out of their consciousness completely, or they will completely disclaim you and deny they even know you anymore. I mean, this is how much of a stigma there is to this type of experience.
Well, eventually that's what happened. My this group, for instance, as a matter of fact, I've seen two UFO-related groups just disintegrate for no good reason other than, you know, for some, you know, unknown reason, something that brought everybody together in the group. There's some kind of an unnecessary or invisible force that just breaks the group up, you know. Right, and there's a certain amount of denial here, you know, that occurs when people come to grips with what it is that they've experienced, and then they want to back off and they don't want to admit it to themselves anymore.
Chris, you have anything?
Well, can I just say something? Yeah, I also have spent a lot of time with abductees, and I did very well with them. Everything was fine, but I did have to actually sign an agreement that I would protect their identity because they all had high visual jobs and placements in society and did not want to lose those positions. So I did
exactly. That's the point. Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes.
And the group stayed together. However, and I got amazing information from this group. At the end of it, at disgust at how what I was writing about them was being received, and that no one showed any interest in wanting to be They were looking for a professional university, a professional group of researchers or a university or government agency that was serious to come and talk to them, and they would agree to do that. And since they all had physical alterations to themselves, I'm going to put it that way, physical problems from their abductions, they agreed for the first time to be examined. And I could not get anyone to be interested in them. And that, when I went back to them and said, no, I'm out there, I'm sending out letters, I'm writing about it, I'm asking for, research companies to please, organizations, to contact me, and nothing happened. They became so angry and so disillusioned and frustrated that they insisted we break apart the group and went our own ways. And, it's really, really sad. So there's all kinds of aspects to this thing and reasons why reliable, good people that have good information and should be listened to get disgusted and walk away. Also, I think...
Well, I've experienced that myself, yes.
Yeah. And I also think that they felt if we continued together and it went on, that their abductions might come back, that we may be broken up in a different fashion. And they were afraid that not only they would be taken again, or worse, one of their children or someone in their family. So they were really, really afraid of that also. So it's a very interesting thing. You think, we're going to put all these people together. We're going to get all this information. It's going to be wonderful. Doesn't work out that way. And it's very interesting to me what you're telling me.
Well, let me give you an example. I was going to do a UFO documentary with a producer for Plano Telecable. It was Richardson in Plano Telecable. And so we set up a schedule of editing events, that we were going to use, for the storyboard and everything, everything we're going to do. And one of them was we had gotten a referral from a Florida policeman who had been present when a UFO had hovered over a large crowd of people, and it had left the area, circled the area, and come back. And it was, it was like witnessed by so many people so vividly. And then the officer, when he submitted his report on the incident, it was like all of a sudden he just ran into all this official obstruction. And he couldn't understand why, he was running into so many problems over simply doing his job and reporting an observation that included a lot of people. Well, it got so bad that he ended up quitting his job, and apparently he'd gone through a divorce and he had custody of his daughter. So he moved to Irving, Texas, which wasn't a great distance from, Plano, where, we were going to be shooting this documentary. And the strange thing was is that as we got into the documentary and did our planning and all the areas that we're going to go to, and I had to contact the U.S. Air Force and ask them if we could do some routine footage at Carswell Air Base. And then we, we had a couple of people, official, type trained observers like this policeman and another gentleman who was at Whiteman Air Force Base when a UFO landed right in the middle of a Strategic Air Command base. And I got his filmed and written testimony and put it in a newspaper article. And then I was going to carry him over into the documentary. Well, just everything slowly but surely just started falling apart. And all of a sudden, it was like the studios were saying, well, we're about to be purchased by a new owner and you're not going to have access to the film studio anymore. And I'm going, wait a minute now, wouldn't this new owner be interested, in a film project like this? But, it was just like nobody all of a sudden wanted any part of it, And this poor officer... First, he was all, like, you know, willing to do the project and everything and give us an interview, which I thought would have been really good. And then all of a sudden he got paranoid and backed off, and he said that it might not be good for his life. Is and I'm going, well, I said, I can just give you an interview. There doesn't need to be a visual, okay? I mean, you know, and he just got paranoid and just backed off. And, you know, apparently for some people it takes a lot of courage to do this, you know, because they're going to go through official denial or, you know, people are going to raise their eyebrows at them and say, you're not from around here, are you, pal? You know, or whatever, you know, connotation. You're not one of us, are you?
You're going to get attacked if you talk.
Yeah, you're going to get ridiculed. Exactly. Yeah.
And there's you.
I guess it's just the unfortunate, just an unfortunate, you know, implication of this manifestation, you know.
Yeah. Oh, and it's very interesting to me that the people that stick with it have the fortitude to do stuff, because they do take, I know I have, I'm sure Randy has, and I'm sure you have, you take a beating from people, and again, they either want to use you, it seems, for the information, or abuse you because you're giving the information. It depends on what group you're, you know, talking with. The abuse also is out there because a lot of these people need to be protected. They have jobs, families, and communities they live in. And I really don't know why you need their, you know, name, telephone, and address in order to get what happened to them out there. I'm more interested in what the event was and how they survived it. And, you know, that's why they talk to me, and I refuse to give out their information. But, you know, it's a difficult subject matter. And I really, to this day, don't understand why people are so afraid of it.
Well, we've come a long way. There's no doubt about it. I mean, think of what the people in the 1940s and 50s had to go through. I've heard of people being run out of their homes, you know, out of their towns. Because, you know, they reported a sighting that they saw. And then because of all the attention they got from the press, you know, coming into some small town and everything, all of a sudden the people, you know, literally forced this person to have to leave. And, they end up being like a marked man for the rest of their life or something. I don't see how a lot of people had the courage, you know, back in the 50s and the early 60s and even in the late 40s to actually admit, you know, to what they were seeing, because they were really labeled as being wackos, you know, on the lunatic fringe.
Yeah, and we don't need to look much further than probably.
I think today we're very fortunate, you know. There still is the subtle ridicule, you know, and unfortunately there's also the government influence, you know, in other words, the rise of the security state, the police state. You know, there is a subtle air of suppression, you know, that people have to consider there, especially if they're in the military or a police officer or somebody that's in some official capacity. But for the normal civilian citizen, generally, things are a little easier, I think, you know, today than they used to be for people.
So you've been writing and reporting.
What do you think, Randy?
Well, oh, you're not hearing me. That's why I was muted out. Sorry. Actually, the audience was hearing me. You weren't hearing me because I muted. Never mind. It's a ridiculous situation. We have so much recorded information, and when you guys were talking, I was thinking about just the evidence that was put out, for instance, by Leslie Keene in her book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials, and the official record that she established there. We have reams of information, both on the record and off the record, and yet there's been an official policy since the late 1950s that the media would not touch this subject, and it was officially taboo, which is what everybody who tackles this at any level above Well, apparently even community level TV, you simply can't go there. And yet at the same time, you think back to the 1970s and you look at the movies that started coming out, Close Encounters being one of the earliest, but there were some other films as well, and we're almost like a schizophrenic society. On the one hand, we entertain these ideas in terms of fiction, which is beginning to look more and more like real fact. It's almost like they're merging. And yet at the same time, our so-called major media will not touch this story except if they can do it with a smirk and a grin and a wink.
Right.
Hey, Randy, do you remember the words of Noel Coward? He said something about entertainment doesn't necessarily reflect life, but life reflects entertainment. You know, so, you know, there are some people that are convinced that the UFO sightings that, you know, manifested themselves in the population in the 70s and 80s or whatever may be the byproduct of, you know, human psyche that's experienced these B-movies that came out, these sci-fi movies that, you know, that came out during the 50s, you know, so now it's been melded into the consciousness of people, and they're starting to manifest, you know, illusions or mirages or whatever. I don't buy it, but, you know, there's no doubt that, you know, pop culture and real life bounce back off of each other. You know, when you think of War of the Worlds, you know, and what happened in 1938 with Orson Welles' radio program and how that created a mass hysteric panic. And then we come to find out decades later that it was an actual social experiment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yes.
And yet people were killed. You know, I mean, you kind of wonder to a certain degree, you know, if, you know, there's a certain amount of government disinformation or manipulation involved in this whole, you know, in this whole twisted equation that we're trying to figure out.
Well, on the other hand, and I guess this brings us into the first area that I really wanted to go in with you, Doc. I mark 1947 as the beginning of the UFO era. Now, I come at that from Roswell, and at the same time, I've always considered Roswell to be kind of problematic. I've heard an array of opinions about Roswell, and really, I've never been comfortable, but for some reason, that's the demarcation line. 1947 mm-hmm. appears to be the springbed from which we launched into this whole sequence of events. And I cannot be convinced otherwise that regardless of what happened at Roswell, the sightings that we have had reported in a steady stream, and in some cases a gusher like we had in the late mid-1960s to the early 1970s, and I'm speaking specifically of my area here in Pennsylvania, we had major flaps. We had major flaps over Washington, D.C.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Over Los Angeles, over Texas. And these have been recorded and documented, and I don't think you can attribute this to public delusion. Some of the people who I knew who saw the craft back when I was a kid were not subject to delusion. They did not read sci-fi magazine. They were not staying up late at night. Well, you couldn't stay up late at night and watch TV then. And they certainly weren't listening to Coast to Coast. So the problem becomes cause and effect, or effect and cause, and I think there's a lot of confusion because the confusion's been sewn into this whole meme. So can you share a little bit with us about what Roswell means to you? Because I know you've written about it on UFO Digest, and I'd like to get your take.
Oh, God, I've written endlessly about Roswell. I started writing about Roswell in 1993, first of all, and my first take on my first articles with the Plano Star Courier were that the major reason for the suppression of the event was that the status quo, the authoritarian state that existed at that time, in other words, you know, what we consider to be normal reality, had been faced with a major requirement of concealment, which caused, you know, the basic emergence of the security state you know, that it wasn't anything compared to what it is now. But, I mean, it began. I mean, the National Security Act.
Yes, isn't that interesting?
Came about in 1947.
Yeah. And, of course, Rich Dolan's done a lot of research into this, but he's not the first person who got this. I was on radio back in 2003 talking about the National Security Act and all the synchronicities that went on in 1947, being Roswell and the National Security Act and all these strange things that were happening in the world at the same time. And it was like, why would you need a National Security Act unless you had secrets you really wanted to lock down? Because,
yeah, some kind of unprecedented event had to have occurred, you know, that convinced people that there needed to be, I mean, extraordinary measures exercised by the government.
Many people have said that that was a reaction to the realities of a world post-World War II, obviously post-nuclear. But, in fact, what most people who have not studied those documents don't know is that was a complete reconfiguration of our country away from what had traditionally been what we call a republic into what we now winkingly call a democracy, which is basically a technocracy that was enabled by all these agencies that were generated off the National Security Council.
Mm-hmm. No doubt. But, you know, I think that, you know, and really, you can go back as early as 1938, and there is already evidence that the government knew something and had already recovered a crashed disk. And that there was a Secretary of State in 1938, Cordell Hull, that actually introduced a friend who was a pastor to a deep basement storage area underneath the White House where there were supposedly four entities stored in glass containers in formaldehyde. And that he told this minister, he said, and they were very, very good friends. They grew up together. So he trusted this guy implicitly. Okay. And he said, and there was also the recovered vehicle in that same storage room, and there is also a former White House employee that was at work for the government at that time that did testify that at that time there was a large basement storage area that she said could have been like an exhibit hall in that time, and that there was this vehicle, this circular vehicle that was there too. And anyway, what Cordell Hull told the guy was, he said, now the reason the government has not revealed this to the people is because it's afraid there would be a massive panic. And go to Roswell another 9 years later after World War II, and here they are again trying to preserve, you know, the existence of all normal conventional institutions and philosophies and religions in our society. Because if this comes out, not only will it probably break down people's belief systems, but the government will lose control because the illusion of normality is no longer there. This could create a huge panic, a breakdown of all, you know, conventional, you know, beliefs and wisdoms. And, of course, the government wants control. And one way that they maintain control, of course, is by keeping secrets, you know, to very, very crucial information like this.
And yet at the same time, if you go back far enough in history and you begin to look at some of the objects that have been retrieved from Egypt and you begin to study some of those very cryptic bas-reliefs and etchings out of Egypt, you notice that there are these very strange beings depicted there that look a whole lot like giants.
Like spacemen?
And spacemen. And then the spacecraft themselves depicted in those same etchings. And you go forward into a more modern period where you have all these pictures of Jesus and the Holy Mother, and they have not just halos around their head, but they have these very strange-looking craft flying in the background. And we're talking about paintings mm-hmm. that go back into the 12 and 1300s. So something's been shaken in history for a long time. And it appears as though what we call normal reality is entrained reality that has been programmed into us to keep us from finding out what they consider to be a rather inconvenient truth.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, we are, unfortunately, I would have to say, and I just wrote a couple of articles about this, that we exist in an actual matrix. It may not be an electronic matrix that controls our consciousness, but if you look at the exclusion of reality and truth and the screening of you know, the type of news events and what the White House wants us to think and believe, and that, you know, we should, you know, not consider the U.S. Constitution to be, you know, the beacon of light for our freedoms anymore, that the president, you know, thinks that, you know, that the U.S. Constitution is an obstruction to what he wants to do for the people of this country. When you look at the way the news services slant, you know, reporting, and we know that's been going on for decades with the UFO problem as well, is that even if they do report a sighting, it's always you know, tongue in cheek, like, this is kind of a joke, so don't take it too serious.
They run it on the entertainment segment of the program.
Opinions expressed are those of the UFO nuts on the program, you know.
And if you take and add into that the fact that we are having almost shoved down our throats, definitely the generations after us, all the young people, technology to the point that they are constantly wired into what I'm going to call the grid, the control grid.
Mm-hmm.
They are constantly being downloaded and controlled by the very forces that you just described. We are being, I think, wormholed into a place that I don't think mankind really wants to go. Yet we're running there as quick as we can and striking out and angry at anyone that brings up the point, maybe this isn't a good thing for you to do. Maybe you need mm-hmm. to get back to one-on-one communication and dealing with your friends in the flesh and being in contact with people and not following the trend of what you're being force-fed on these wireless gadgets 24 hours a day, because it's all...
Oh, how many times have you almost gotten run over by somebody? I mean, how many times have you almost gotten run over on the highway by somebody that is sitting there texting while they're driving because they just can't be away from it?
Right.
You know? It's just... It's even further than an addiction. It's mind control.
Well, it's emerging into our consciousness of the electronics. I mean, basically,
right.
you know,
becoming,
years ago, people used to talk about the coming New World Order and how everybody would be chipped. I would argue that there's no need to chip anybody. We did it to ourselves already.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Don't put down our chip.
And so it's another...
You know,
you cannot...
Go ahead, Doc.
There's an old saying, it's when your servant becomes your master. And that's exactly what has happened, because the electronics that were supposed to amuse and make our lives more efficient, because we could, you know, stay, you know, in touch and we could keep files more efficiently, you know, and more effortlessly, so that we could just keep doing more and more work. Well, now it's become our master.
Absolutely.
It controls us.
Truth.
We don't control it anymore.
And we do
and,
not
and,
know.
And these young people, they don't believe it. They're not even aware of it. You know, I mean, their government has been taken over in a soft coup. Mm-hmm. And as long as they were on the internet and they had their, you know, their as long as they had their iPhones and could watch their internet movies and everything else, that's all that made any difference to them. Their freedoms can be eroded as long as they have their electronic escape.
It's an amazing situation. And it's going to really get problematic, because we don't know what's being downloaded into everyone's head. As long as you're connected to a wireless gadget, unless you have something like that on you personally all day long and are using it, you also do not know what might be being downloaded into your brain, and you're not even aware of it. And no, everybody thinks I'm crazy when I say that. It's not crazy. And
well, no, not with the advent of MK Ultra and all the, you know, CIA programs, you know, and what the the Soviets were doing years ago by being able to actually pinpoint, you know, microwaves, you know, into a building and cause people to suffer mental aberrations in U.S. embassies and in some points even have hallucinations projected, you know, into their mind, you know, by an outside remote source. And then not to mention the fact that you can raise the human consciousness to such a level that you can have what's called remote viewing, where unfortunately for only military purposes, they have a number of subjects that meditate and bring their mind to a certain level, to where they can actually, when they're given a problem to solve, like, you know, where are the hostages being held? Or what building are these secret documents that we need to get, you know? And then these guys visualize, you know, where this can be located and where our intelligence services can go to confiscate it or capture it or take it out, you know, with a surface-to-air missile. And, you know, all of this has been going on for decades now, and it's culminating, you know, in a lot of the military applications seem to be culminating, you know, in civilian life, and there's going to be collateral damage because of it. Already is.
Well, the interesting thing about that, and you brought up remote viewing, and by the way, I will be interviewing Courtney Brown next Saturday, what is that, the 10th of September, on video. So for those of you out there, stay tuned to the website. Courtney's going to update us. But the remote viewing thing was a sequester government program from the 1970s. Now, they developed it for intelligence purposes, but they have a problem. Because if you go talk to the natives, if you go talk to the shaman, they laugh and they go, well, you need a program to do that. You see, one of the great lies that's been told is that these people were special. Well, in fact, our human abilities to operate in that realm of consciousness were born into us, and in fact, I believe, bred out of us. And some of us are beginning to reclaim this, and I think this is actually what they fear.
Well, it's actually pretty dangerous when it has to be extracted for military purposes. That's the unfortunate, you know, realm. As a matter of fact, here, I think one of the original MK Ultra operatives just died here recently.
Yes.
He was the luminary, the whistleblower that made a lot of people aware of what was going on and what the actual objectives were that they wanted to attain, you know, using MK Ultra. But I'll tell you quite truthfully, in the underground bases that we've got, the DUMs, the deep underground military bases that are located all over the U.S., the USSR, Britain, supposedly a giant underground base in China, they're using MK Ultra initiatives or protocols, you know, to control the people that are working underground, to suppress phobias that they might get from being underground for long periods of time, and to also keep them from divulging what they know to the public, so that all this remains, you know, under the veneer of being impossible, conspiratory, can't give any credibility to it. Yet the stories are emerging, and it has taken decades for the truth to get out.
Have you had any communication personally with whistleblowers that have come out of any of these programs, Doc?
Well,
that you can talk about.
You might want to say I'm not really at liberty to divulge. You know, I would never reveal, you know, anybody personally.
No, that's not what I'm asking at all.
Information from. Okay. Yeah, I've talked to a few, you know, ex-military people and that I've met, and it's pretty shocking what they told me. That, and this starts from about anywhere from, you know, acquaintances I've had in the late 70s all the way forward, you know, to UFO crash retrieval conferences that were being held in the mid-2000s by the by Robert Wood and his son in Las Vegas, that my wife and I used to go to we attended three of them. And you know, the you have your, you know, your ex-military intelligence people and other people that were involved in various aspects of the Cold War, and it's a real eye-opener. And unfortunately, the government doesn't always tell the truth to people whose lives are on the line, but they are reassured that, oh yeah, you will survive. But when people start putting, you know, the equation together and start putting a slide rule to it, or start actually saying, okay, just tell me about how, you know, it is that I'm going to survive in the event that something like this happens, and they find out that they're being lied to. And I, you know, was raised as a kid, you know, George Washington, Valley Forge, you know, we're the, you know, we're the beacon of light in the world and everything else. And sadly, there is a shadow government operating apparently behind the facade that we look at the, on the White House, and those people don't have our best interests, you know, in mind. And these black projects are probably funded in the trillions.
Yeah, I think it's so. If that those numbers are even meaningful anymore, because it gets so staggering that you just keep tacking zeros on the numbers, and it's kind of like, don't tell President Obama what comes after billions, because that'll be the next budget. Oh, that's right, that was the next budget.
Right. Oh, that's right, there's a debt ceiling coming up, isn't there?
Yes, yes.
Oh, got to blow through that one. You know, I can't stop spending money.
Well, this is a problem. We have an addiction to this because we've become a nation of, I hate to say it, parasites. Everybody sucks off the tit of government. Pardon my indelicacy here, but I know a nice way to say this. And it does come into the subjects we're talking about, because the way they control us is through our money. And they've controlled our consciousness through our money, through the ridiculous system of advertising,
entertainment,
advertising on TV, contouring our thinking by what we watch on the screen in front of us, rather than us going out and training ourselves as we should. Specifically, and I'm talking about going out into nature and becoming plugged into the earth again, rather than this electronic mind control grid that they've built for us. So I mean, it's all connected. And the reason I ask you about you know, and I was not looking for you to disclose names or anything, is you know these people, you know what they go through. Even if they talk privately, sometimes they're going to be harassed. We've had whistleblowers, we've interviewed. Oh, here comes the evening.
Oh, let me tell you, I mean, it's amazing how, you know, how these people can be eavesdropped. And I got to tell you about this one circumstance, and it was pretty freaky. It was back in about 1989. I'd been invited to go to a meeting where there was a Unitarian church, and there was a former U.S. Air Force radar officer who had seen something that he should have kept his mouth shut about, basically. He was stationed in Britain, and he was standing in a radar facility. There was a lot of brass there. There was a huge radar screen he was observing, and there was a UFO sighting. And apparently it was, well, let's put it this way. Apparently it created a great deal of concern, maybe even anger with the brass that was there, because basically they thought they had the situation under control, and they didn't. So anyway, he was sworn to an oath of secrecy after this sighting. And, well, you know, being a young man and being stupid, you know, he went back to the barracks and either he told a friend or a girlfriend about what had happened. Well, he was called on the carpet within about 2 or 3 days, and he was dishonorably discharged. And it didn't stop there. He went back he lived in the southwestern region of the U.S., and walking across the street in a small Arizona town towards a retail strip that had a second floor to it, you know, asphalt, you know, three-lane, you know, main street of a small town, a bullet strikes the pavement probably under a foot away from him, and he has to go running across, sprinting across the street and seeking cover, you know, against one of the buildings. And then later on, within weeks of that particular experience, he's driving down a highway in the middle of the high desert of New Mexico, and out of nowhere, a high-speed Lincoln Continental, completely black, comes up from behind him and starts trying to run him off the road, to the point where he finally has to just throw his brakes on and pull over off the shoulder in order to keep from getting killed. And he was convinced after that, and I'm sure he was absolutely paranoid after that, that the only way he was going to stay alive was to stay in the eye of the public and to give lectures and to talk about his experience and be on the lecture circuit, so that as long as he was visible, he might have been a target, but they weren't going to take him out, because then obviously it was going to draw too much attention to what had happened. And everybody was pretty spellbound, you know, hearing his testimony and everything. And, you know, kind of, you know, you realize the darker side, you know, of UFOs, and when the government gets involved, and then what starts to happen, you know, once you have this out of control, you know, shadow technology and leadership, you know, that gets a hand in this.
Well, it's an amazing thing. You know, when I grew up on Long Island, and in the 60s, UFOs were seen all the time. So the natives of Long Island were accustomed to it, to the fact that it would be in our local newspapers all the time, and we thought nothing about it. However, when we contacted the military, I know it happened to my parents. When I had an incident happen to me, they called the military, and the Air Force, came to my house and flat out threatened my parents that if they continued to talk about this, no, it was going to be a big problem. And then they went to my two little girlfriends that also had the same experience with me and threatened their parents. The parents got together and said, this is not worth somebody getting hurt. Just tell the kids not to talk about it.
But then again, this isn't supposed to happen in a free society either, is it?
No, not at all. And the three little girls, by the way, got no help, got no medical help, got no, you know, assistance that they, and no one to investigate the fact that they were taken and abused and physically harmed. That just was too bad. And that's the way our society deals with it. If you took another little girl and took her someplace and abused her and everything, oh, it'd be a big deal. The cops would be there. They'd be investigating it. They'd be searching for the people. They'd be trying to protect her and the family. It doesn't happen to people in these types of incidents. You're on your own.
That's true. You know, there's an interesting book that... Who is this? Jacobs. It's the other guy who's an artist that was one of the first people to start helping the abductees. Bud Hopkins.
Bud Hopkins. Okay? Yep.
His last book before he died was called Sight Unseen. And I feel so sorry for Bud, because he had just married, and apparently he married a really bright, you know, attractive wife, you know, and I think he... you know, he had some health problem that just started getting worse and worse. You know, you could see that there was some, there was a growth underneath his neck towards
coincidence, maybe?
Yes, yeah, because look at Carla Turner.
Yeah.
Carla Turner died of, you know, she was an abductee specialist, and she died of a strange, you know, form of cancer. Go back to Ivan T. Sanderson, the pioneer of USOs. He died of a fast-acting cancer. You know, some of this is just too coincidental. But anyway, getting back to Bud Hopkins, he found out that a number of abductees go through this for decades, and that there are what are called screening memories that are injected into their consciousness by the entities, and where, say, a person was abducted, and they have a false memory that is placed there that is, it's a form of anxiety, and it represents a vague event that the person can't really get their mind wrapped around, mm-hmm. but they can't get through to what actually happened until they go through hypnotic regression. And there was one go ahead.
Doc, I just have to interrupt you. That's why the group of abductees that I dealt with, which were very bright, highly educated people, absolutely refused to go near anyone that had the idea that they were going to hypnotize them. They would mm-hmm. not allow it because they were afraid.
Well, I've been in regressive hypnosis before, and it is an important tool. But a lot of people think, well, if you get hypnotized or whatever, you're going to lose control, or somebody's going to make you do something you don't want to do, or whatever, because of these guys and, you know, that these entertainers on Las Vegas that say, when I tap my knuckles three times on this desk, you're going to have an incredible urge to urinate, you know, and then, you know, everybody laughs because the poor person goes running out to the restroom or whatever. You know, people think that this is going to happen to them if they go through a regression, and you know, it's a scientific way of trying to get, you know, the mind to stop repressing and to actually open up and experience the source of the fear and clarify what exactly happened, because the human mind tends to use repression, you know, to denial, you know, to try to keep from dealing, you know, with the source of anxiety. The terrible
experience. Well, that's not the reasons that they gave, but I'll leave that for another time. That has nothing to do with their not wanting it, but you know, I guess that's personal. My group of abductees would not even consider it. They felt that it was just the absolute most dangerous thing that you could do to them, because there's no human alive that understands the technology or what was done to them. So the fact that some mere human with very little knowledge of what happened to these people went in there and tried to mess around where their memories have been suppressed or something else was put there. If these people were fearful their brains would be wiped out or they would remember something horrible, but far more worse than that, they feared it would make them have another experience. Because
I wouldn't trust an institutionalized method. I wouldn't trust an institutionalized effort. I would trust somebody like Bud Hopkins,
yeah,
because he had a lot of experience.
I wouldn't trust anybody. Not one human on this.
But you get people in a like say in an institutional setting, you know, where it's a college or a university, and they've got DARPA money. Forget it. You know, I wouldn't let anybody. You know, I wouldn't be subjected to it, and I wouldn't recommend anybody else get subjected to it.
Can you share a little bit about your own experience with hypnotic regression? Since we got on the subject, it would probably help to round out the conversation a little bit.
Okay. I was raising four kids by myself, running my own business, and, you know, just been through a lot of, you know, bad luck or, you know, making some bad personal decisions. You know how they say the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And I wanted to reevaluate my life, and I had just gotten blindsided, you know, with, you know, by a fiance that I had fallen in love with in a whirlwind romance. So I was going, geez, I need to stop this. You know, I need to change my life, you know, and just, you know, maybe going to church and saying prayers or whatever, just, you know, it wasn't enough, you know. So this lady advertised, you know, that she had she was from SMU, which is a very well-known university, and she had a degree in what was called Rohan Regressive Therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody suggested, you know, because I was, you know, I was around a lot of people involved in, you know, various areas of you know, consciousness, you know, experimentation and stuff. So, this person said, I can regress you back to experiences in your childhood. I can take you back to past lives. If you have reoccurring issues in your life, a lot of times this can be as a result of something you may have experienced in another lifetime. And I must admit that I've had some strange dreams and everything that may have indicated, former lifetimes. And so I went through it. It was just kind of like hypnosis, where, you know, you relax, you get quiet, you do some mental exercises, you know, to become more receptive to the experience and to get your mind at a certain level, you know, like at the meditative state. You know, some people, it's not alpha, it's actually the beta level. And then the person just quietly kind of leads you through, questions about what you want to explore. You know, you make an agreement about what it is that you're after, what you're trying to find out about. And so I was trying to come, you know, into contact with my spiritual guides, what influences had caused me to arrive at the place that I was in my life at that time, and what could I do, you know, to improve the quality of my life and not keep making self-defeating decisions. And I was told that this lady said, you know, I've known some people that, I mean, they go into, you know, sometimes not hysterics, but they get extremely upset because they experienced a trauma from another lifetime, and it has affected them in this life. I have, you know, met people that, you know, they, you know, for the fee that you're paying, I'm going to give you 2-hour sessions, and we're going to explore, you know, everything, you know, that could be affecting you that could go back to, you know, our previous lifetimes. And you will also not only be able to identify your spiritual guides and maybe even the moment you were born and what your spiritual relationship was with your mother, but also that you would be able to identify the true love of your life, or who it was that you were going to end up with, you know, as your soulmate. And so I thought, this is all intriguing. You know, I might as well just give it a whirl, because I was really thirsty, you know, to find answers, you know, and to improve my life. And especially when I had 4 children, you know, that were relying on their daddy, you know, for everything that they had, you know, and certainly didn't want their dad to go off, you know, the deep end, you know, and I wasn't about to do that anyway. But, you know, I you know, was interested in improving the quality of my life. So, you know, I don't look at it personally from my experience as being anything that I was ever out of control. And in a sense, it allowed me, I guess, to envision some things that I normally probably wouldn't have been able to pinpoint without having guidance.
Mm-hmm. Did you, as a result of the hypnotic regression, confirm what you already believed, or did you get new data that changed your perspective on your life or lives?
I found out some things that I had suspected only, that I had instinctive, you know, suspicions about, that were confirmed, you know, and then there were things that maybe I had expectations for that were not realized. I mean,
I really, really wanted to find love very, very, very badly, and I think I was searching so hard for it that if it had been in front of me, I wouldn't be able to see it. You know what I'm saying? Have you ever been in that mode, so to speak, where there's something that you want so bad, but you're so busy searching for it, it eludes you, you know?
Well, I think so, everybody, yeah.
I think I came to peace over a lot of things that were bothering me, but it didn't give me the ultimate answer, no.
And I wouldn't suspect that anything external would. I guess what I was looking for is, I know there's different types of regression therapy. I know there's different people out there that practice it. And I think Chris expressed some concerns. I've had them as well. Is where you have somebody with an agenda. And there are some well-known people out there in the ufology world. And I would not consider Bud Hopkins to be one of them at all. But there are people out there that have an agenda. And I've seen
results
of that where there is programming going on. And some of it is kind of turned in a way that makes me very suspicious. And so from that standpoint, it's kind of an individual choice of how we go about this. From the standpoint of people who have experienced traumatic events and alien abductions and things like that, and I know a number of these people, I think caution is the word simply because of the kind of ground that you're touching upon. In the case of people who were under mind control, I would absolutely say no. That's a dangerous hole to go down given the level of intervention that's been done into people's minds, into their physical bodies, and the fact that you have alternate personalities that in many cases are programmed to kill. So you would want to think twice about that. So I think that was kind of my concerns, and it was my interest on what you gleaned from that experience.
Right, and I will tell you that I think this lady did have an agenda, but it did not affect me, but I was aware of what her agenda was. I believe that she was a sexual child abuse victim,
mm-hmm.
and that she tended to project that as, Freudian, observations about anxiety, like everything must be, the result of sexual repression.
Right.
And in some cases, Freud was probably right. In other cases, he probably wasn't. Well, I think this applied to this woman, I think she was making an honest effort, but unconsciously she had that agenda, which was, there must be tons of people that are, sexual abuse victims and they don't even know it because they're repressing it. I know that that was, part of her agenda. So, knowing that, she couldn't project it into me or make me believe it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But she was skilled enough and was also consciously committed to improving the quality of somebody's life that, that didn't become a hindrance. But you knew it was there. Because sooner or later she touched on it, and then I knew, even under, and I was deep under it in my third session, I was so deep under that it took her a while to get me out. It was like being in a deep sleep, before she brought me out. And I kind of wish she hadn't, because that was my most lucid experience, that I had at that one point. And, I didn't want to come out. I think that's what it was. I enjoyed being there so much. I didn't want to come out of it. I wasn't ready to, so I think that, everything that you experience in life and whatever it is, whatever tool you want to use to, explore a way of clarifying your understanding about life and what's going on and everything else, it's up to you, to determine how it's going to affect you. We're not necessarily always victims.
We can't agree with that completely. Yeah, I resist the victim mentality as much as possible.
Right. It's just a great excuse, and we got a whole nation
full
of victims, that are sucking off the government's tit right now.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
And, yes, I'm in total agreement with you on that.
We're gonna.
And, you know,
gotta,
you said go something. Ahead, Chris. Can I just say,
yep.
Doc? You were talking before in a conversation, and it's something like went off. I thought this is really horrible. Yes, we are becoming this nation of controlled. Everybody, you know, subsidized off of the government. We're becoming this broken nation. We don't go out there and, you know, take care of ourselves or build a business anymore. We're just these things. And I used to think, well, that's going to stop because eventually everybody's going to be hurting and they're going to be so broke and, you know, so poor that they're going to realize that this is...
They'll have a realization? Exactly.
You know what happened?
Yeah, that they'll have an epiphany. Right, but you know what? I don't think anybody would be capable of having an epiphany. You know, once they allow themselves to get like that, I know that there's a certain rationale among, in government that, oh, well, if it gets bad enough, the people will finally wake up. Yeah, right.
Mm. I gave that up, and I'm going to tell you when. When they started giving out cell phones and things like that to the welfare people.
Obama phones.
He gave me a cell phone.
That's when I gave up. So, in other words, they're not only going to drive them into non-functioning adults and a society that's not functioning at all, they're going to give them the tools to keep them under control.
Exactly.
I gave up at that point. I gave up.
Intentional dumbing down.
Yeah.
Yep.
At a time,
intentional dumbing down.
To keep them there.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't give someone a cell phone because they don't want to work. That you just don't do it. You know, there's no initiative for them to want to. Why would you want to work if you're given every single thing you need and controlled so that you can just sit?
Yeah, but you see, what you're given keeps you in mediocrity. What you're given by the government keeps you in mediocrity. It does not open your mind. It does not make you a better person. You do not expand your awareness. You do not contribute to society. You only become another unit, a programmed unit. You have no individuality. You become mediocre. And that's what the government wants. At least that's what, you know, people in the leftist radical realm want.
Well, the society better wake up, or else that's it. It won't be long. It won't be 100 years. It won't be 50 years. It's going to happen in our lifetime, where that's what we're going to end up being. A bunch of media.
Yeah, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, guys, I need to call time here. We got to take a break.
Yes, I need you to.
Okay.
Hold on. Stay on the line. And when we come back,
I gotta get a glass of wine.
You
man.
got 7 or 8 minutes here. We're gonna play some music. But when we come back,
800. We come back.
I want to talk.
Flight 800.
I want to talk a little bit about the modern era of ufology and specifically the Archuleted Mesa and what you think's been going on out in Dulce all these years. So if we can turn the corner on that.
Get ready for a wild ride, I'm telling you right now.
We're ready to go. We'll do that when we come back on the other side of Off Planet Radio Live. I'm Randy Moggins with Chris Holly, and my guest tonight is Doc Vega, and we will be back in about 5 to 7 minutes, depending on how long the tunes are. We'll see you when we get back.
This is Tell Me Something you're listening to on Planet Radio.
My name is Matt Presti, producer of the Secret of Light series. I would like to invite you to attend the first annual Russellian Science and Philosophy Conference in conjunction with the Center of the One Heart Homecoming Festival, September 7th and 8th, 2013, in Waynesboro, Virginia, at the former home and location of the University of Science and Philosophy. Several speakers will present on the power of love in action, the cosmology of Walter and Leo Russell. Don't miss this opportunity to attend a life-changing event. Get your lodging secured in Waynesboro, Virginia as soon as possible. Volunteer positions are available for those who wish to help. Call Richard at 1-800-741-1012. That's 1-800-741-1012. And visit thesecretoflight.org and oneheartcenter.org for more information. To donate to the event, visit theoracleinstitute.org. Special thanks to Randy Maugins of Off Planet Radio for sponsoring this infomercial. See you at Swannanoa.
This is never before. Environmental hazards, genetically modified foods, toxins in the earth and air, chemtrails, and escalating radiation levels. How do we get control? Thanks to the work of a team of researchers, we are pleased to announce a revolutionary natural technology that can help your body rebuild its original coating. RNA Drops is a complement formula based on the newly discovered iCell. RNA is the building block of DNA. These new DNA structures are the gateway to what is called ascension. Many users of the RNA Drops have discovered the benefits of a product as unique as their own biology, finding newfound well-being, peace of mind, and a sense of control over their destiny. Like me, they are enjoying a sense of empowerment within their own bodies and emotions. To get all the details on RNA Drops and to find out how you can obtain a free mini bottle, go to rnagenesis.com. That's rnagenesis.com.
You are listening to Off Planet Radio at offplanetradio.net and offplanetradio.com.
Welcome to another dimension, a dimension of insight, a dimension of understanding. You are entering a place where reality collides with truth. There are no limits, there are no boundaries. This is Off Planet Radio.
Back to hour number two of Off Planet Radio Live. I'm Randy Moggins with Chris Hawley, and our guest tonight is Doc Vega. And just a reminder, next week Ken Pfeiffer will be back with world UFO photos and news, and we're going to talk about sightings around the world. And That should be a pretty fun time. Ken came on the first time, and he kind of blew it out. He had a great time, and he likes doing live radio. And we like doing live radio, too. Welcome back, Chris, and welcome back, Doc Vega.
Thank you.
So this hour, we're going to cut to the chase because we want to talk about, I call it the modern era. I don't know where the distinctions go. But you indicated something interesting to me, Doc, that you correspond occasionally with Norio Hayakawa, who is somebody I interviewed very early on in this show. And Norio was one of the people that kind of tipped me over to some research that had been ongoing about what happens out in New Mexico in what's called the Arcoleta Mesa, also known as Dulce Base. And I know you've researched this and done some writing on it, and I think it's a subject that is due its course.
Well, you know, it's an ongoing mystery that has endured at least, well, we're talking about four decades of mysterious manifestations now. Anything from cattle mutilations to townspeople experiencing strange vibrations and sounds emanating from underground. and the local Yakariya Apaches reporting that the face of the Archuleta Mesa literally opening up like an interdimensional porthole as a UFO passes into it. It's just, but there is a history of, you know, of U.S. military involvement, of direct underground conflict and death and firefights with entities. And then supposedly a truce and arriving at a mutual agenda and cooperation with these entities at the same time. Leading many to some very, very grave speculations that there are genetic experiments going on that are part human, part alien, and even part intersplicing with animals, like you know, the genetic material that has been removed from mutilated cattle.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, the government, you know, keeping, you know, a veil of secrecy around it, and unfortunately even more when they have to resort to it. So there's an ongoing investigation that I'm part of and participating in, and I have to say this about Norio Hayakawa. He was way ahead of the curve.
Norio was one of the pioneers. He was...
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about 1988, and he already had a televised, you know, documentary about it, and nobody had any clue. And, you know, him and his camera crew and, you know, I mean, are actually have to be accosted by the local police chief, you know, asking them, what are you doing? What are you here for? And there was a definite, you know, atmosphere of suppression involved, you know, because they did not want this attention in Dulce. They did not want it, and they knew what Norio, they already knew what Norio was looking for, and they didn't want him to find it. I've been with Norio. We've been in Albuquerque. We've been around Kirtland Air Base. We've done a little bit of trekking in some of the sensitive areas, and, you know, he's a courageous guy. He does a good job of correlating the information, and he and I were both very much in agreement that it is just part of the human consciousness experience that people do not connect the dots. They just don't. When you have a number of suspicious activities going on or events that have happened and transpired in rapid fire sequence that all point to one conclusion, a lot of people just won't connect the dots. And it's denial, it's fear, government conditioning, and I called it the coincidence, you know, that nobody wants to admit to. And Norio agreed. He said, you're right. He goes, you know, people don't want to pull these coincidences together. They just want to let them occur as isolated incidences. And when you do that, you start to ignore the body of the evidence if you're going to do investigation. You know, and, you know, he was expressing a lot of regret over the death here recently of Gabe Valdez, who for 21 or more years had, you know, conducted investigations into the Dulce cattle mutilations. You know, he was a highway patrol guy that was, mm-hmm. This was his, you know, area of responsibility, and he conducted forensics, you know, site, you know, evidence gathering, and you know, he was keeping his own files and his own records. And when he died, he left that with his family. And at the time that I met Norio here in person after corresponding with him for some time, a few months back, Norio was rather perplexed. You know, he was going, man, I don't know if Gabe's family is going to just, you know, out of fear or out of intimidation, if they're, you know, just going to let this lie, they're just going to let sleeping dogs lie, or if they're going to, you know, take this evidence that their beloved, you know, father and grandfather had collected, and they're going to do something with it. Well, quite luckily here, just a few weeks ago, the family did, you know, release their father's evidence and files in a book form, and you know, that was a big breakthrough, you know, on this deal. And anyway, for once, you know, we've got some people that had enough courage, to allow, you know, this information to be shared with the public instead of being, you know, forced into obscurity.
Well, and rightfully so, mm-hmm. They would have been scared. How familiar are you with the story of Phil Schneider? The structural engineer.
I wrote about Phil years ago. I mean, yes, it's incredible what that guy went through. And, you know, and I've told people what happened to him. The guy was dying of cancer, and he was killed professionally by assassins that tortured him.
Yeah, he was garroted, right?
Yes. And it's just like, why did they have to do this to a man that had already made, you know, public, you know, lectures, and they knew he wasn't going to live too much longer, and they went ahead and they killed him with extreme prejudice. You know, it just goes to show you, I mean, that,
well, and,
you know, there are some secrets that just don't want to die. You
well,
know?
And this is...
There are some people that don't want to let those secrets die.
Dulcie is one of these secrets that's been oozing out. Now, we're going back to the events that Phil Schneider relayed that occurred in 1979. For listeners
right.
who don't know, Schneider was a structural engineer who was involved in the building of the underground, the Dumbs, at Dulcie in the Archuleta Mesa. And
yeah,
he was
yeah,
one
he
of the people.
He analyzed geological strata.
Yeah. And he basically walked away with the story and apparently some physical evidence of a 1979 shoot-off out between military and gray aliens under the ground in the base.
Yeah, there was a firefight.
And so Schneider was eventually, by all accounts, taken out. I mean, there's no way to put it. He was, as you said, professionally murdered. And so the whistleblowers who might be motivated to come out and speak about Dulcie were silenced for years. How have you looked into Paul Benowitz and the story there as well, Doc?
Do you know that when Norio and I got together and he was telling me about Benowitz, he even took me by Benowitz's widow's villa that she has on the outskirts of Albuquerque, close to the Kirtland Air Force Base property, where Benowitz used to stand on top of his roof and record images of UFOs that were flitting about and hovering over Kirtland Air Base. And being a very good guy with a very, you know, incredible relationship, you know, with the Air Force, with his Thunder Labs, you know, nuclear calibration equipment, you know, that he was making for the Air Force, they said, well, you know, we'd like to see those films that you've been taking of those objects. And so, you know, being the good guy that he was, he just turned them right over and said, well, here you go. And all of a sudden, his life slowly but surely became a living hell. And he eventually was, I believe, institutionalized, had a nervous breakdown, and the quality of his life rapidly, you know, deteriorated from that point. And still his poor widow is living in that house that they both shared, you know, still staring out, you know, at the Kirtland Air Base where her husband used to, you know, focus his attention, you know, on those evenings that he was filming, you know, those objects. And you know, he's got three sons that have taken over the Thunder Labs. They will not make any public comments about their father and what he went through. And I understand from Norio that they visit their mother, you know, on the weekends. And, you know, he and I drove by there. I was very saddened, you know, thinking about, you know, what her life has turned into and losing her husband over these circumstances and everything, and yet still remaining there. I was very saddened for that.
Wasn't it very, very interesting how the people with the most compelling stories are discredited or murdered, or usually discredited and murdered, and how all of a sudden all the research dries up? And I know there are several people out there, and Anthony Sanchez is one of them, who has been doing work exposing the information at Dulce, and apparently Anthony suffered horrible nerve damage as a result of something he encountered when he was up on the Mesa several years ago. He described it to me. But it seems as though this is like the ultimate taboo subject. Why do you think that is? What do you think's going on under there? I pressed... it looks like we lost... Looks like the whole line dropped. Nice. Isn't this amazing? We go to talk about Dulce, and all of a sudden, the flipping phones die. Well, that's just way too much of a coincidence. So we'll stand by here, and hopefully we can get our callers back in. Yeah, this is the topic that they really don't want people to talk about or consider, because it is the 5,000-pound elephant sitting in the middle of the room in terms of what's really going on. And they do not want people to know. Here we go. Come on back on.
Another ominous drop-off.
Oh, yeah, I was just talking about this. And we're just doing it naked. I'm not even trying to mask this. We'll bring Chris in. There you are. Hello. Welcome back.
Hello.
And thanks to the NSA
guys who felt
they needed to nuke our call.
Well, luckily I'm still alive.
Yeah, well, we'll just get calls whacked around here for the most part. We're not quite big enough.
But, Sanchez, Norio and I were talking about that, and that's very unfortunate. You know, he lost his wife during the course of the book, and
yeah.
Norio believed that, let's just say, an intelligence element within the government decided to go and maybe take a stressed marriage and maybe an element of romance to it, and diverted his wife away from him.
Yeah, these are tragedies. At the time that I interviewed,
and you know what, that is as well as I do, there is a complete history.
Yeah.
Of women are always used, you know, to seduce, you know, people that the government wants information from, or to find out they're a spy, or to turn an intelligence agent, around and bring him, you know, into the fold, or to identify him and get rid of him, whatever, there's a long history of it. So what Sanchez went through is extremely unfortunate and tragic, you know, just to produce this incredible book that he came across with.
When I interviewed Norio in 2010, UFO Highway was actually in pre-release. In fact, at that time, the book was in a PDF form, pre-publication, that had been uploaded to a server in the event of, you know, the unthinkable. But Norio, at the time that I interviewed him, was being very guarded about what he would say, even regarding the phenomena of UFOs. I actually was very frustrated with the interview, because when I got Norio on, I thought, this is one of the pioneers. He's going to be one of the keys that can unlock some things. And he kind of did.
Well, he's going to be in the NFL Hall of Fame for ufologists, let's put it that way.
But what I got from him was that at the time, he was either fearful or he was not ready to disclose what he actually knew, because the interview was frustratingly short on substance in terms of actually coming right out and saying this was an alien insurgence into our civilization, if I can put it that way. So,
well, let me tell you about Norio. Publicly, he likes to remain objective.
Mm-hmm.
But if you get him by yourself, like, you know, I mean, I've dined with him and spent, you know, a lot of time with him, and he's very pro, okay? And he just does not want to come across, I think, as being so pro-UFO that it damages his reputation. He wants to remain objective so that, you know, he is not, so that he cannot be discredited. But unfortunately, when you take yourself to the point of almost being on the edge of skepticism, you know, yet you're still saying, but I believe there's a scientific possibility here, then you almost put yourself on the same footing as debunkers, you know, only, you know, you're just a little bit further to the right than the debunker is, you know? So, you know, I mean, I know from talking to him, you know, what his, you know, real views are and what his real beliefs are. And actually, he's very courageous because for several years, he held the Dulce conferences right there in Dulce. Right there in the lion's den. And I think that if somebody really, really viewed him as a threat and wanted to take him out, they had a perfect opportunity. You know, and God only knows, I mean, I hate to see anything like that happen to him. And what happened to Sanchez is just, you know, I don't know why they picked Sanchez, you know, and unless he really got, you know, close to the, you know, inner sanctum. And maybe they just thought that, you know, that Norio wasn't doing as much damage. You know, that's the only way I can look at it.
I kind of had the sense that Norio was actually going out of his way to make himself appear harmless, even with the reports of him being down at several conferences and showing up and playing what amounted to basically a lounge act. And I have the suspicion that that was kind of the mask that he put on to prevent himself from being taken so seriously as being seen a threat. On the other hand, you know, what happened with Anthony Sanchez goes far beyond
it's
the most
very disturbing.
Off. It's disturbing.
Very
because,
disturbing.
Because, you see, now we're in this period where everything has been messed with. There isn't even the ability to do shows like this with people like that are nearly impossible. I mean, sadly, I can't get mm-hmm. Anthony on my show because of political things that happened. And that's mm-hmm. not personal between he and I. It has to do with certain filters between people. But
right.
And anybody that's listened to my show knows this. My problem is that on every level, we have what is now lockdown rule in the alternative media to the point where we have to second guess both our own responses to things and the responses of people who come out as whistleblowers because they can turn on a dime now. And see, I think that is the real game that's being played now. Taking people out draws attention. It's kind of like why they won't do the Kennedy assassination again. I mean, they almost did it with Reagan. They're not going to do it again because it creates too much attention. It's far better now to Bill Clinton them than to blow their head off. So we're kind of in this place now where whistleblowers and witnesses are discredited or they discredit themselves deliberately.
Well, unfortunately, the low information voter, you know, the typical mainstream, you know, Joe that, you know, always worried about his groceries and his rent, you know, and, you know, whether his kid's doing good at school and what his next, you know, reality show or celebrity, you know, competition is going to be about, you know, so he can escape from, you know, all the stresses of life and, you know, having a few beers and watching the ball game on the weekends. I mean, this is what the government wants. I mean, you know, they want the, you know, the obedient sheep, you know, the ant worker. And what better way to do that than to introduce socialism into a system to where, you know, the government values the worker and tells everybody, you're being a good worker, Ant. Just keep working. We're going to raise minimum wage for you. Just keep working. Don't think. Keep your head down.
Well,
don't worry about what we're doing. We'll take care of you.
Our culture is way past that. Our culture is way past that because they've already imploded their own economy. You know, we're now at the place where I think these guys may have overplayed their hand, as they do many times. Socialism, well, we've been in one form of socialism / fascism for a long time now. How did we get from there to there?
It's never been, it's never been as pervasive and blatant as it is now, especially when you had a president that came in and he said, I'm going to redistribute wealth. And people said, oh, well, that sounds good. What does that mean? Well, I'm going to show you what it means when I start legislating it. You know, then you wonder why we have an economy that's only growing at 1.7%, and we've got 50 million people on food stamps, and we've got an actual figure of unemployment that's more like 15%. You know?
Well, you know, ultimately...
whatever.
Yeah,
you know.
Ultimately, they've been at this for a long time. I mean, you know, going back to the establishment of the Federal Reserve and fiat currency, I mean, we've not
exactly
not been a free people for a long time. We gave up our power when we gave up our money, because there is no money. And the truth of the matter is, even their fiat currency has now failed, as it did in 2008. And they've got severe problems.
Well, if they weren't floating the economy like they are right now by buying $80 billion... In treasury notes or treasury bonds right now, we would start seeing catastrophic inflation and devaluation of the currency. So we're floating artificially right now, and we'll be lucky if the U.S. dollar does not fall from being the world reserve currency. And of course, it'll never be admitted by Obama and the government. It'll never be admitted by the U.S. media until one day the whole bottom falls out. And we are experiencing exactly what the Germans did after World War II, when it would take a barrel full of marks to buy a loaf of bread.
People don't... I lived in Germany in the 70s, and Americans aren't aware of the fact that that was a country that... nobody owned a house unless they were very rich. It's exactly where we're going. Everybody had to rent. Nobody owned a car. You had to walk. And you didn't accomplish that much in your life. That's exactly where we're heading. And it's not a good place to be.
Yeah, there's the middle class vaporizing, and you're just going to have poor people and the very, very rich.
Right.
Right.
It's going to be the rich and the poor. And you are not going to own your own house. You're going to be lucky if you have a roof over your head and food in your belly. And if you're a nation of sitters, though, and you just want to sit through life and have that little bit handed to you so you can sit through life, and we don't have any builders left and doers,
You don't have any innovators. You don't have any motivators. You don't have any Bill Gates left anymore. You don't have any Steve Jobs. You don't have any Teslas. You know, you don't have any Henry Fords anymore. They're gone.
You don't even have a little guy that can open up a laundromat and do well and support his family and own a house on it. It's all gone.
Well, now, you know what they're going to do? They're fixing to impose a 40% income tax on small business. That is just going to kill whatever's left of the entrepreneur in this country.
Well, when entrepreneurs are outlaws, then only outlaws will be entrepreneurs anymore. So we'll just wind up being the mafia.
Right. Like what's going on in Russia.
Exactly. Well, Russia is the perfect example of what this will look like. The post-apocalyptic America will look like that, but it'll probably also look like Road Warrior.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and don't forget, and everybody should know, that living in Russia is not a good life unless you're filthy rich. And the filthy rich in Russia live well.
They are
come
ruthless.
To New York City. They come to New York, right. New York City and buy $25 million apartments just to have on, you know, the cake in case they happen to fly here for a weekend. The mm-hmm. world is really off kilter and out of tilt, but not enough of society is grasping it. They're just sitting there and
believe
saying,
it or not,
oh, okay.
Believe it or not, this all has a tie-in with Dulce. It all has a tie-in.
Oh, I'm so glad you're going to make that connection for us, Doc. Go for it.
Because it's going to blow your mind. And, you know, I was reading it, and I mean, I'm already very well aware of the hierarchy and the, you know, and the Bilderbergs and the, you know, and the ones that yeah. own the Federal Reserve, the families that, you know, have basically held a financial monopoly for at least two or three centuries. And, you know, have, you know, there's a, just a hand-picked few families and individuals that are on top of the food chain on this, in this world. And that they're going to dissolve the, you know, sovereignty of all nations, dissolve the borders. Why do you think, for instance, that, you know, the federal government is fighting efforts of all the border states to protect our borders? Because of the North American Union Agreement, where Mexico and America and Canada all become one, you know, and subject to the world order, you know, but the Dulce thing, I couldn't believe it. You know, first of all, what blew my mind was that they had what was called the Muroc expedition, mm-hmm. according to Anthony Sanchez, mm-hmm. which was, you know, a Muroc airfield originated detachment of soldiers and engineers and aviators that were tasked with the mission of establishing an underground base under the aegis of a nuclear test facility where they were going to weaponize the results of the Manhattan Project. Now, they found a naturally occurring 7-level underground tunnel and interconnected system of caverns in Dulce. And they said, wow, this close to Los Alamos and this far from, you know, any huge population center and this far from prying eyes, how perfect does it get? So they began, you know, their expedition of you know, man and material began to penetrate the top of the Archuleta Mesa and into the subterranean enclosures. Initially what they found was what appeared to be a natural cavern and tunnels until they started finding in their description, we're talking about 1940 terms, these soldiers and technicians looked and they saw what they thought were huge radar screens against the walls and what looked like typewriting machines connected to them by glass wiring, multicolored. And they said, my God, I don't know what this is, but that must be the weirdest typewriter I ever saw and the biggest radar screen I've ever seen in my life. And then they touched them, you know, and they were flexible. And it was everything that we would call an LCD or an LED screen now, only even thinner and flexible and still resilient. And, you know, the commanding officer took a look at all this and he's going, my God, we're into something way over our heads. And so they went further into the caverns. And what they found was the caverns now were lined with a thin granite-like paneling that finished the walls. And when one of the soldiers touched it, his glowing fingerprints were shown for several minutes after he touched it. So the soldiers, in curiosity, started writing their names with their fingers. The commanding officer says, don't touch that. Leave it alone. So they found this incredible instrumentality that comes from, I mean, they know this stuff surpasses the finest equipment that they've got right now, which is radar and you know, teleprompters, I think they had back then. You know, I mean, it's better than anything they've got, you know, and these guys have seen it all, okay? And so, and then one of the soldiers says, this has got to be German. It's got to be German. But they had a realization as they walked through the tunnel. They said, man, this stuff's been around for hundreds of years. This isn't only better than anything we got now, but it's been around for hundreds of years. So they progressed further down this labyrinth, okay, of well, you know, apparently well-organized underground passages. And they started finding Indian artifacts and Colt 45 guns and bullets and spears and arrows. Then they started finding bodies of Indians. They went further and they started finding bodies, childlike bodies, with huge enlarged eyes and strange long arms and hardly the hint of a mouth or an auditory opening. And blast marks against the walls. In other words, there had been a firefight. There had been shooting. And then that's when the commanding officer said, stop right here. And he knew of a guy that was an archaeologist and an anthropologist and had forensics experience. In 2 days, they airlifted him there. And from that point, they began collecting the artifacts, cataloging them, containerizing them, preserving them, and the expedition went further, penetrating further and deeper down into the caverns. Suddenly, they were aware that they were not alone the further they went down. And along the main caverns, there were side corridors that had been abandoned and weren't used. So here you have soldiers that are lugging equipment in, and they're packaging the artifacts and taking them out, and they're seeing figures in the dark and around corners. But they're not addressing it. They're not responding to it. They don't consider it to be a security threat, at least not yet. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So this is 1940, and this is the testimony of, let's just call him Colonel X, interviewed by Anthony Sanchez. And, you know, if you want to say, well, this is all ambiguous and we can't, you know, prove it, or go back to the MJ-12 documents, okay? Let me tell you something about the MJ-12 documents. All the document experts went on and they went, oh, this is a fake, this is a fabrication, there's no way these are actual documents. And Stanton Friedman started looking at all of them and he said, you know what? He said, I have looked at all types of historic memos and documents and files from the U.S. government dating back to the early 1940s. And he says, and these are the same ambiguities and the same inconsistencies and the same document numbers that don't add up as anything else that I have seen that is either considered to be historical and proven. And it's no different than these Majestic 12 documents that were mailed anonymously to William Moore, a ufologist that worked with Friedman back in 1985. And when I opened up the FBI vault that was released in December 2010, which was an incredible collection of all these historical UFO investigative memos and documents. And I mean, the stuff's hard to go through. It's hard to read because, I mean, we're talking about stuff that, you know, was printed in teletype back in the 40s, you know, and they did probably a lousy job of scanning and photocopying a lot of it, but it's still there, you know, and it's hard to work through. And I spent hours and hours and hours of going through those documents and reading them and then, you know, correlating, you know, and summarizing them, you know, to, you know, and, the FBI took a look at the MJ-12 documents, you know, about 1987, 1988, and they resubmitted them to the Department of Defense, and they said, you have had an oversight. You have something here that was never intended to be declassified, and you let it out. Don't tell us, you know, that this isn't the real thing. Now, yeah, you're going to use your disinformation, you know, to debunk it, you know, to the general public. And they just basically threw it at him and said, this is your responsibility. You screwed this up, okay? So getting back to Anthony Sanchez's interview of the colonel, could we shoot holes through it and say, you just materialized this and, you created a straw man and all this. Let me tell you something. There's much too much knowledge of intimate command detail and different compartments and levels of intelligence involved in this information that you would have to know a hell of a lot to try to fake something like this.
Doc, when you were talking about this before, you mentioned that they felt that this was an area where they were doing alien and human splicing or
hybridization.
Genetic experimentation. Okay, do you know why? This is the theory. They're saying that the alien race that pretty much created the Greys, the little Greys, who are servant not robots, they're biologically programmed entities. UFOB is the term that early in the 1950s Project Blue Book started using, which was unidentified flying object biological entities, but they called them UFOBs.
Right, EBs. Yeah.
Okay. They were engineered to serve their masters, and yet their masters realized that they had the ability to get out of control and to become too powerful. And apparently there was a fight between not only the Greys and their masters, but also the inbred humans that were interbred with the master alien race, because they were doing this to perpetuate their own progeny. They were a dying race, and they knew that if they did not combine with the positive DNA of a healthy and robust race, that they would cease to exist. So they had to attain, you know, an infused, you know, existence, you know, infused, you know, with the biological, you know, similarities of another race, a lesser race, one where, you know, they would have all the dominant genetic ability, but still would be dependent, you know, upon the other genetic superiority in order to remain viable and without becoming extinct. So we go back to Dulce, and we go back to 1940, and this is all going on, and it's been going on for anywhere from 26,000 to a million years. Okay?
Here comes that coal train.
Uh-oh.
Randy's. Yo, it's really loud.
Yeah, no, you're hearing it through the studio, Mike.
I was thinking it was some kind of a cue. Okay, we're going to go into break comment.
I had muted out on the studio microphone. You guys are on a separate channel, so you're hearing the train. Yeah, that's the Burlington Northern coming down from the coal regions, heading off to deliver its load of combustible carbon materials somewhere. We don't know exactly where that goes.
Yes, and you know that horrible material that actually gives us the infrastructure to maintain our electrical grid, which will become destabilized here pretty soon.
It's interesting, isn't it, that we're still burning coal all these years later. I got reports on the chat that our audio is cutting in and out for the last 30 minutes, which is, you know, about concurrent with the time when our phone lines dropped the last time. The monitoring here in the studio for the stream is dead rock solid stable, and this is a brand new website that was maximized to do this. So
why does this always happen when you start talking about UFOs?
It happened when we started to talk about Dulcie and hybridization, because I don't know, they apparently have the ability to, well, we know what they have the ability to do. So I said the NSA.
Well, let me tell you something really interesting, Randy. We can go all the way back to Roswell in 1947, and they had a recombinant genetic scientist that was involved with that autopsy. And they have traced a history of his employment in a number of different bases, and then he just drops off the face of the earth and disappears. So we know that even as far back as 1947, that the powers that be were already addressing, okay, the recombinant
right.
factor.
Predating the official human genome
DNA
project.
And its implications, okay? So why, if you've got a weather balloon that supposedly everybody misidentified, and I think Jesse Marcel was an absolute hero, then why do we bring in a recombinant, you know, geneticist, you know, into the fold? You know, it must have been some really special weather balloon.
Doc, as I think it was in the year 2003-2004, which is far away from Roswell and all of that, just to show you that this is just a continuing saga. In 2003 or 2004, I had a newspaper article when I was reading my local newspaper here about a body that was found on the shore of Plum Island, which is very close to end of Long Island. And mm-hmm. the body was of a man, and he was about 6 feet tall. He had a strange hole in the back of his head, and he had 18-inch long fingers. Well, Plum Island, we weren't surprised. The locals, they've been doing things like that for years with animals, and there's been UFO sightings there forever. You know, the government would shoot at you if you went near the place, so forth and so on. But here we had a
local cop. You think he could have been an obsessive compulsive fisherman?
And they took the body, and the police said, yeah, it's really, we don't know what's going on there. We never saw a human like that, and there were some other anomalies on his body that I didn't get. But it was well known, it was in all the local newspapers, and the government, the local police took the body and took it to wherever, the morgue, I guess, out there, and the government mm-hmm. came in and took it, and that was it. We never heard about it or saw it again.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
This has been going on since probably the beginning of mankind, and they actually, I guess, got a good one out there, but he had that hand problem, you know, when he's dragging a 3 feet long finger, hands along with him. But this has been going on forever, in my opinion. And that's exactly.
Well, can you imagine? I mean, if you caught that guy with his hands in the cookie jar, that'd have to be one big cookie jar.
I just wouldn't want to shake hands with him at all. But these bizarre things, and it was in all the newspapers, it wasn't hidden. But nobody.
Well, that's great. I commend the newspapers. They actually reported that?
Yep. And the local police
that's incredible.
Admitted to it. Yep. But then it was just.
Yeah, I'm sure the story didn't last very long, but I mean, at least initially it got reported, right?
Right. And then the local police admitted, well, the body was taken from us. We weren't able to autopsy it or anything. They came in and.
Men in black showed up, did they?
Well,
hey, you know what? I can guarantee you if that happened in L.A., I doubt the story never would have even got released.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, you take a look at what happened to Andrew Breitbart and Michael Hastings.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, talking about a forensics operation that'll hide anything from the government, there you go.
And one of the abductees that I spent a lot of time with was a medical doctor. And this doctor told me that she believes that they are, and she doesn't know, she also feels it's a human-alien combined governmental thing working with them, and that they let them take as many of us as they need to do what they're going to do, that's the agreement, and cover it up, she feels they're draining the people's adrenal glands. And definitely it's all about biological material that they need that can no longer produce.
Right, yeah, this supposedly goes back to an Eisenhower-era negotiation that went on between Eisenhower's administration.
Right, right.
And the aliens, it basically came to them and they said, we'll do two things for you. You give us what we want. And we will give you technology that will make you superior to any nation in the world. If
and
you resist, we will make this proposition to another nation, and they will be the greatest nation in the world. Take your pick. So we allowed... there was a caveat that Eisenhower made, and it was, we'll let you abduct, we'll let you mutilate, you know, the animals... But we want the people returned to the place that you got them from.
Well, so, that happens in a lot of the cases, but I think in some of the cases, they just take them. But, I don't know.
You're pretty convinced of the story that Eisenhower did meet with ETs out at, was it Andrews Air Force Base?
Supposedly Holloman.
Holloman, that's the one.
Supposedly Holloman, in New Mexico.
The existence of an alleged treaty that was basically allowing them to exchange technology in exchange for human bodies, basically, or human DNA.
Yeah, I think Linda Moulton Howe kind of touched on that with Alien Harvest.
Yeah.
Which is really chilling, really, really chilling.
You see, there's so many debunkers out there now. I mean, this goes against everything we talked about the first hour of last week's show with our guest then, who was a very nice guy, but frankly was touting the company line. And I know that the listeners then were kind of pissed off about that. So, guys, we made it up to you this week because we went there. And people are entitled to their opinions.
Yeah, well, let me tell you, I hate to say this, but I guess I'm more on the devil's advocate side.
No, I don't see any other explanation at this point of why this massive cover-up, why we have... I've interviewed enough abductees at this point. Their stories are consistent. They're not delusional. They're very wounded people, and they're people who have stories much like we talked about tonight. Including some of my witnesses that told me directly they have been in underground bases and seen the genetic experiments that are there. Everything from alien-human hybrids to human-animal hybrids, which is not new.
Well, let's just say that this doctor also added that she came to this conclusion because of the diseases that the people, the abductees would develop afterwards would come from that type of abuse to the human body. And furthermore, felt that when it goes like in family lines or there's like specific groups of people that seem to get targeted for this horror, you know, Rh negative blood, different types of things, light haired, light blue eyes, all those kind of things where you can't deny it when you talk to the people and they all fit in the same category, that they actually like farmed from the beginning of time these people to use for their biological needs. And I got to tell you, that to me is disgusting. And I think it's a possibility. So they take
in... Well, I mean, when you've got people that are, you know, they're talking about you know, finding scars on their bodies from what apparently, you know, medically you would describe as being a scoop,
mm-hmm.
you know,
scoop implants.
Right, you know, but they'll do a scoop for a cancer test, you know, for a tissue test.
Sample.
I forget what they call it. Sample. There's a medical term for it. It's escaping me right now. But anyway, you have people doing that, and you have the, you know, people finding, you know, the foreign objects in their bodies. And when this podiatrist, this foot doctor who's been a ufologist for a long time, was on the History Channel on a UFO show, and he extracted...
That would be,
you know,
Dr. Roger Lear, right? Yeah.
Roger Lear, yeah. There you go. I've met him personally. And he removes this object, and it has it emits a low voltage signal. Okay, and yet it appears to be just a piece of foreign material. But you see, we are now arriving at this where they're going to start putting chips in people, and it won't be long before they start doing that. You know,
let me
off these RSS transmissions.
Mm-hmm. Let me tip the listeners. I'm going to be interviewing Jeff Harvey, who's a former naval intelligence officer and electronics expert. On Saturday, and we'll release that the early part of next week. That's private session, and he's going to talk about the chip that Roger Lear had taken out of him. So we're still documenting this stuff.
But I
yeah, and Roger Lear, you know, can't account for the ones that got stolen from him. You know, after
well, that's actually what Mr. Harvey's going to. Yeah, I mean, and yeah, no. They've been taking them. He basically has certain degree of autonomy, but unfortunately, no one does this research without money that comes from them. So, unfortunately, even our best researchers sometimes are a bit compromised.
You know, I have specialized, you know, in the more cryptic, you know, and the older and the classical UFO cases, and I'll tell you why. Because I believe right in the very beginning of this entire enigma that we already found the answers. And right now what we're doing, you know, in the era of the years of, you know, 2000 and whatever, we're basically just recovering that ground, but we're doing it with better technology and with a different perspective. Go to 1958 and Anthony Boas, who was a South American guy that got abducted.
I've heard about this before,
yeah. Yes, and he said that, you know, first there was a landed craft and he didn't know what the hell it was, and then he became, like, disoriented, and he was guided into this craft, and he said there was what appeared to him to be a woman, but she was not a woman as we would think of, you know, as a human woman, even though she was probably a hybrid, okay? And they put some kind of an ointment or a cream on his skin, which was a transdermal hormone, which probably, you know, allowed him to become sexually aroused. Then he claims to have had sex with this entity, this female entity. And she made sounds like like an animal, you know. He felt like during the whole time that, you know, of this intercourse he was having that you know, she was making like sounds that were more like an animal than a person. And then, you know, he got finished and
it just makes you glad I'm not makes me glad.
After, right. They were after, obviously, you know, his ejaculate, you know, his DNA or whatever. But they allowed him to do it, you know, in an intercourse fashion rather than extracting it, you know, painfully with, you know, the insertion of a needle.
Yeah,
or whatever,
right.
Would be my choice.
Yeah, that would be mine,
too. If
you're
going to get my DNA material, please let me enjoy it while I'm doing it, you know.
It just makes me glad I'm not single and don't have to date anymore because I understand that they're out there.
That's right. You know,
well, there's whole memes about
this. You want to do
now.
A little bit of, you know, you want to do a little background check on your next date, right?
Exactly. Yeah, you single guys out there, be careful. Make sure that the eyes slant in the right direction and look out for any telltale signs of reptilian. We got about 2 minutes here, and then I'd like to wrap this up for tonight. It's really been a lot of fun talking to you, Doc, and can you tie up the loop on the political economic side and the Dulcie thing real quick?
Well, as far as Dulcie is concerned, I think it is the example of the government, conducting, a socioeconomic cover-up, a shadow government, appropriation, revenue, collecting for, what must be multi-trillion dollar expenditures that have to come out of the government budget some way. So, here we have a government that is spending too much money, we're in a huge deficit, and maybe part of the reason the government refuses to actually make that deficit, find a way to make the deficit balance itself is because of this black budget that is taking up so much of the government expenditures that they have to keep demanding more and more revenues from the public, whether it makes any sense to anybody or not. Other than that, nothing makes sense about, government accounting and balancing the budget or anything. There seems to be such an obstruction by the government to balance the budget.
Well, here's the problem.
I think part of it has got to be that damn black budget they're funding.
You actually closed the loop perfectly. I just had this conversation. I think I had it with my wife last night. Do you recall the day before September 11th, 2001, when then Defense Secretary Rumsfeld appeared at a press conference to try and explain away the Pentagon's loss of tens of, I think, billions of dollars
that
had disappeared?
Oh, they just flat lost. What was it? They couldn't account for how many billions?
Yeah, it was lost.
It
was enormous.
So they do what they always do. They did the disclosure, but then, son of a bitch, they had to blow up some buildings and put a bomb through the Pentagon. And, I mean, it was just, it's so inconvenient.
Well, you can't spend all that money without having some damn terrorists to kill.
That's right. So you threaded that loop.
God only knows we got to, get rid of a few civilians and, that might be in the way.
Yeah, so we just, that was beautiful. You closed that loop perfectly. Doc, tell people your activities, tell people where they can find you, and a little bit about what you're up to these days.
Well, you can go to docvega.com. There's my, I've got three fictional novels that I wrote that all hint at every bit of this, even though I've got a supernatural detective novel that hints at all of these issues. I've got a novel that one's called The Ridge, another one is called Incident on Crichton One, and the third one is called Demon in the Dark. Those are my three novels. And I'm actually going to contribute, I'm going to charitably give $3,000 worth of perfectly printed books to the USO, to our soldiers.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I called the USO, I said, what can I do to help you guys? Do you guys like action novels? Do you like, do they? And they said, man, they read that stuff up. They love that crap. I said, well, I'm right down your alley, so I'm going to be delivering, just wonderfully printed books to these people, and to help our soldiers out. It's the least that I can do for them.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That's great.
So,
that's wonderful.
DocVega.com,
yeah.
And you can also be found over on UFO Digest, where you have...
Right, and I'm on Politicide. I'm on Now Public... Open Salon, Our Salon, 12160.org, which is a conspiracy site. I have lots of publications, you know, pick my, you know, my articles up, you know, and republish them. You know, I'd be nice to make a little money at this. I make a little bit of money.
Yeah,
but
we
not
keep
much,
saying
you
know? That too, don't we, Chris?
Oh, jeez. Every
yeah.
day we talk about it.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, I've been, you know, pretty much banging my head against the wall for a number of years now, you know, just, I think Sean Hannity once, you know, made reference to, you know, politicide a couple of times, and, you know, there, I've gotten some recognition from, you know, some of the, you know, well-known speakers for, you know, a particular.
Our, phone lines are fritzing out here. I think we are losing the system, so, well, it's been a fun evening. I don't know, is the stream still running, or how did everything just crash? We've got nuked. We've suffered through it. The recording will be up on the website as soon as possible. This has been Off Planet Radio for July 31st, 2013, and I think this game is over tonight. We will see you all again next week.